So today's talk is given by Professor Chris Brunston, Professor of Geographic Information at the University of Leicester. Professor Brunston's interests include patterns of crime, house prices and health data, some things. He is one of the originators of the technique of geographically weighted regression, which models geographic variations in modelled variables, as opposed to traditional, simpler perhaps, methods of regression, which assume these to remain constant over an area. So without further ado, over to Chris.
Well, thank you very much, Owen, and I'd like to thank you for your hospitality, and I'd like to thank you very much for your hospitality. I've been given some water to drink, but it's also this, so that's very civilised. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is basically, geographically weighted regression, as was mentioned, but also perhaps to extend that idea to one or two other techniques that I'm applying this idea of geographical weighting to. Hence, I've decided to call the talk Geographically Weighted Analysis. There are other kinds of analysis you can do with this concept of geographically weighting things, which I'll explain as the talk goes on. And I suppose what I'd like to do, again, probably slightly contentious, like a review and prospect, but what I'd like to do is talk initially about geographically weighting regression, which is probably the first of these techniques that we looked at, and that's the review part of it. And then a bit what I call the prospect part of it, which is moving things on to other forms of geographically weighted analysis. So really that's the sort of structure today. And for each of those, I have two sort of examples, which I'm going to show you how they work on the slides here. But I'll also sometimes, as examples, mention a few other sorts of areas of study. Because one of the things that perhaps has been found about these techniques is rather like regression itself, basic regression, which can be applied to a lot of different areas. These techniques have over time been applied in a number of areas, so perhaps I'll try to give some idea that that's actually happening in this case as well. So, what is geographically weighted regression? Well, in a nutshell, what I'd say is basically it's a local statistical technique to analyse spatial variations in relationship. And what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, let's suppose you weren't interested in relationships between variables. You just wanted to look at a single variable. And let's say you're interested in house prices. Someone might say to you, what's the average house price in London, or in England, or in Great Britain? And if you were to say, well, okay, what's the average house price in Great Britain? It would actually be a pretty useless number, because it would tell you very little about generally what's happening in house prices. The number you'd get would give you, okay, some sort of central value, but it wouldn't tell you about the fact that house prices in some areas were very much more expensive than others, and that there are all sorts of different patterns at different geographical scales. So certainly there's probably an effect that houses in London tend to be more expensive than houses in other parts of the country, in other parts of the UK. But there's also, even if you said, okay, so what's the average house price for London? That would be particularly informative as well, because there'd be lots of different places in London with different average house prices. So the point is that to understand individual variables, it's no good sometimes just taking a national average. You need to think about how the thing varies geographically, and that can explain a lot about certain processes. If you're interested, for example, in understanding certainly some aspects of, say, how labour markets work, knowing that house prices vary in different places is an important part of that. It's going to cost you money to move from some places to others, even if the job opportunities are there, and that has to be factored into things. So, generally speaking, thinking about geographical variation in a single variable is important. What we're trying to argue, though, myself and the other people who've, Stuart Fogginham and Martin Charlton, who have been involved in the development of geographically weighted regression, is the fact that it's not only individual variables where you need to think about how they change geographically, it's about the relationships between variables. Sometimes the way two variables go together in one part of the country might be quite different than in another part of the country. And as a geographer, I can give examples in both physical and human geography where that might be the case. Again, going back to the house price example, one of the things that I've sometimes looked at is things like the value that adding a second bathroom might add to the price of a house. And for example, in areas where the family structure is such that you've got quite a lot of people with families with small children, then you might know that at 8 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to get the kids ready for school and get to work yourself, having a second bathroom is actually a pretty valuable thing to have in a house. There might be other areas where the family
family structures typically aren't like that, where it's of less importance. And the point is, you might then find that there's more of a premium of getting a second bathroom on a house in the first sort of area, just because of the nature of the local population there. And so, just again, if you just try to estimate the relationship between these two variables, the price of a house and whether or not it's got a second bathroom, if you take some kind of average, you'd miss out on that kind of information. And another very simple idea that relates to this is, for example, if you took, excuse me for drawing graphs on here, I hope everyone can see this okay. Now, one of the things that, if you're looking at house prices, if generally you might find that houses outside of very cramped inner city areas perhaps fetch a better price than ones in the middle of cities. If this axis represented population density, and this axis represented the house price, then let's say we looked at some houses in and around the London area. Again, what you might find is that generally, as the population density decreased, if you looked at some sales of houses and measured them against the population densities in the areas where you looked at them, you might find that the price generally decreases as the population density increases. If you went, say, to Newcastle, the same sort of effect would happen. But overall, in Newcastle, the market is such that the prices of houses are generally lower. So you'd still get the same effect, but you get a curve that maybe goes something like that. So if you're trying to model these relationships, if you took the two samples separately, then you get one line like that for London, which is fair enough, and you'd maybe get another line like that for Newcastle. Suppose you decided not to take space into account. There's lots of econometric models, or at least initially there were a lot of econometric models that didn't look at the location of houses, and if you fitted the best fit straight line through that, the interesting thing is what it does is it goes like that and gives you entirely the wrong impression. So there is very good reason, really, why you should take these variations in relationships into account. It's not just a fancy piece of mathematics I like doing for the sake of it, it actually stops you misinterpreting data. So that's the sort of compelling argument for thinking about it. And, well, generally, as it says there, global averages then of spatial data aren't always helpful. I gave an example in terms of house prices when I was talking then. It's also true, say, for climate data. If you ask what's the average temperature in America, that's not a particularly useful piece of information. And again, with health data, quite often we're concerned about the fact that there are higher mortality rates in some parts of the country than others, and just thinking about the national average rate isn't particularly helpful. Thinking about this as a global process, it certainly isn't useful to think of a world average mortality. You know, there's global patterns in that as well. So the problem that can occur with global statistics, and sorry, when I say global here, I just mean for the whole map, not necessarily literally the entire globe, but this problem can occur, as I say, when you're looking at relationships, and in particular, when you're looking at regression models. You know, essentially what these two things were examples of regression models, where you try to fit a straight line model through a set of points that you've got plotted. It's also true with correlation. Again, if you looked at correlation coefficients, if you did split these data sets into the geographical components, then you get a positive correlation coefficient. If you do split, then you get two negative ones. So certainly regression and also correlation are areas in which you need to think about these sorts of phenomena. And another fancier term for this is spatial non-stationarity. Really, spatial non-stationarity means you can't apply the same model everywhere. It's really just saying that certain aspects of geography are certainly not like physics. You can't come up with sort of universal laws that govern everything everywhere. In one place one thing might apply, in another place something else might apply. And there's a number of reasons for that. Sometimes, particularly in physical geography type situations, it might simply be because there are other variables that maybe need to be taken into account. It might be an example for those that came along to talk this morning. I talked about the relationship between rainfall and height above sea level. And certainly there's a relationship between those two variables, but there's other factors affecting it as well. So generally, although there is a relationship between the two things, a bit like on this graph here, sometimes it can be one slope, sometimes it can be another. And that's largely perhaps due there to the fact there's other things influencing it, and that's your models may be incomplete. But nevertheless, it's still useful to look at the spatial variation in this, so it might give you some clues as to what the other influential variables are. So sometimes it's possibly that the spatial unstationarity occurs because you haven't been able to measure or include all of the variables that do affect the process. Sometimes I would argue it's just there because, say, people's behaviour changes in different places. There's different local cultures, which means they might react in different ways to certain things. One example I have seen is in terms of voting, where basically in some areas of the UK there's an axis between, depending on sort of the level of income people have, between voting Conservative and voting Labour. In other parts of the country that goes between voting Conservative and voting Liberal Democrat. So in different areas, again, different models might apply, and the explanation for that might be more to do with sort of local culture than other things, and that's also something you might therefore need to take into consideration. But in either case, the global models would be, I think, a little bit misleading. And the other thing, basically then, is if you're looking at global models, what we're saying here is that models apply everywhere without any space. Basically, they're assuming these processes are what are called stationary. They don't change spatially. And that means that they're basically independent of location. You could take the geographical information out and do all the modelling based on the other information. And what I'm arguing is that in certain situations they don't work. So local models then are models, fairly obviously, where these things are allowed to change. And there's, I suppose, a whole universe of possible ways you could allow different things to happen in different places, just entirely change the models altogether, look for patterns in totally different ways in different places. But one sort of fairly straightforward framework for just exploring whether things change over space is the idea that I've put forward at this point here, that basically you could have a model where, if you like, the template of that model is the same, but the specifics of it change from place to place. So, for example, here, I've decided the idea of a straight line model would apply in both places, but what straight line it actually is changes from place to place. So you still have, if you like, the only globality you've got is the template is the same, but not the actual specifics of it. That's the basic idea of geographically weighted regression. And so, for example here, the model might always be a linear regression model, one of these straight line models, with certain variables included in it, but the actual coefficients, which are the slope and the intercept of the line in this case, might change from place to place. So the template's fixed, but the specifics of it, the coefficients, the parameters can change from place to place. And, okay. Right, so in that case, yes, the spatial unstationarity then occurs when the relationship, or if you like, the pattern that applies in one region doesn't necessarily apply in the other region. And another final example of that is an idea that sometimes happens in terms of data mining and machine learning, where people talk about the difference between patterns and laws. And the idea of a pattern, in this case, is it's something that is some sort of regularity that's seen in part of your data. So there's a bit of your data that seems to show certain things happening, but not everywhere else in the data. And the law is some sort of regularity that happens law is something that happens everywhere in your data. There's some sort of relationship holding, some sort of pattern you can see. And basically, the difference then between a pattern and law is, you know, the universality of it. And universality needn't mean geographically, although in this case it does. And one thing that's been argued certainly about a lot of human geography data is it's essentially all patterns and no laws. There's lots of regularities in different places, but there's very few things that are seen as regularities absolutely everywhere. And so I'd like to give you an example of that. This is some data from the US Census from 1990, and this is for the state of Georgia. And these are each of the counties in Georgia shown in these maps here. This map here is showing you the percentage of the population past university education age that have actually got degrees. And it runs from less than about 6.5% to more than 15%. The darker ones are the places where people have got more degrees. And this is the second thing that comes from the census, which is the number of people, the percentage of each population that weren't born in the US. That's the foreign born there. Now, one thing that happens is there happens to be a university in around about this area. And one of the things that universities tend to have as a characteristic, certainly, is they tend to employ people with degrees. That's, if you want to be a professor or something, it helps if you've got a degree, so that's good. But also, another characteristic of universities, quite often, is that they, because they're very specialised, they don't necessarily just employ people from the US if you're in America, or from whichever country they're in. Quite often, they have a very diverse set of input. You get people of expertise that suits the research and teaching interests of the university from wherever they come from. So there tends to be, in these areas, I'm careful not to commit the ecological fallacy, but generally speaking, you will get larger numbers of people with degrees and also larger numbers of people that weren't born in the US. And quite often, the two things, there's not exactly an overlap, because obviously there'll be quite a number of people with degrees who aren't foreign-born, but nevertheless, they do tend to attract both things. And what you can see is in the north of the state, the patterns for high degrees and the pattern for percent foreign-born are quite similar. But if you look towards the south of the state, although there's variation in those two things, they don't necessarily go together. So this area here is high in percent foreign-born. It's not particularly remarkable in terms of number of people with degrees. You can generally see that whereas around here the patterns are quite similar, when you go further south, the similarity seems to reduce to some extent. So potentially this is a case in point where basically you don't have the same relationship between those two variables everywhere. And this is a statistical device devised by William Cleveland called a code plot. Now what a code plot does is it says it's a way of looking at the relationship between a couple of variables when some other factor changing might affect that relationship. And in this case what I've done is I've taken the northern coordinates, so the north and south coordinate of the centres of each of those counties, and I've split the data into six different groups. And effectively, these bars here tell you the ranges of the northings. And there's a bit of overlap between them, which I'll explain why that is if anyone asks me. But just for the time being, let's just assume that we've basically split it into six groups with increasing level of the how far north they are. So this is basically a group of some of the counties just in the south, then a bit further up, and so on. And in each of these six groups, I've plotted those two quantities, percent with degrees against percent foreign-born, and then fitted a line to them. And what you can see there is this bottom one here corresponds to that line, then the next one to that line, and so forth. As you go further north, so these are the first bottom three, these are the top three, the steepness of that line, and hence the strength of the relationship between the two things, increases. So the level of basically correlation between the things increases. So down the bottom, there is a slight positive effect, but not very strong. But it's much stronger here. And one of the important things about designing these graphs, I should just point out, they all have the same scale. If they did have different scales, that would also make the lines change in slope, but the point is they are deliberately comparable. This is a thing called code plot, which is quite a useful tool for exploring things like that. But you can see there's just a definite, but fairly simplistic trend in this case, of just, you know, going further north seems to increase the strength of relationship. Now, if you want to look at something like that, this is where I'm afraid I've got to bring in a bit of maths, because what I've basically got to do here is say, well, if I'm trying to fit these lines, how do I actually do some mathematics to allow for the fact that things change? Well, a standard regression model looks something like this. So this is y, which is the variable that you're interested in trying to predict, if you like, given a number of variables, x1, x2, that are used to predict it. So let's start off with, okay, I'm actually just doing a single prediction variable here, and let's say I'm trying to predict the number of, or the percentage in this case, of people who've got degrees from the percentage of foreign-born, and seeing whether there's a relationship between those two variables. And the straight-line relationship can be expressed with this alpha and beta parameters. And the other thing that makes this a useful and realistic model, I think, is this thing here, which is the random error term. Any model of the real world that's not got a random error term isn't a model of the real world, basically. And so what makes it useful is you do put that error term in and say what probability distribution it has. And that effectively guides how you actually go about calibrating and estimating these numbers. Geographically weighted regression goes sort of one step further. And again, if you're not sort of familiar with the notation, don't worry so much. But really the only difference you'll note is that each of these coefficients here have U and V after them. Now, U and V here represent the location of a particular point in space. And what they're really saying is, in these models, my regression coefficients vary as a function of space. And one way to think of them is think of them a bit like a terrain or a hill surface. As you go across geographical space, these coefficients go up and down depending on the changes in the values. So, for example, in the Georgia case, probably what's happening is you can think of the slope coefficient of sort of being like a hill that goes gradually upwards as you head north because the coefficient is getting higher. And just to recap on that, you can see that quite clearly. The slope gradually increases the further north you go. So that's a sort of general idea of GWR, and this is mathematically how you say what I've been doing verbally. And I suppose that's the reason why, although the maths can be hard to understand sometimes, people like to use maths to handle ideas like that. I've been talking for 15, 20 minutes. If I had just said that, then that would have got the idea across to a mathematician. So that's kind of why those notations are very useful. The other thing to note is, if you like, my coefficients now are functions. They're not variables. They're actually a function of location, a mathematical function. So that's what sort of changed here. And my problem then, as putting the sort of statistician's hat on, is how do I estimate those coefficients that are now functions? Well, the idea is fairly straightforward. What we do is we say, well, supposing I was interested in working out what the coefficients of the slope and the intercept of my line should be at that point there, where the red point is on this map. Well, if I took a window around that circular window, and then just did a regression model for all of the points that are inside that window, so basically all the bits that are in the pink part of that circle there, and calibrated the regression there, that would give me an estimate locally of what the slope of the intercept of the regression model should be just in that place there. If, on the other hand, I were to move my circle, say, to just that point there, then some of these points would go out of that window, so new ones would come in. You'd recalibrate the model again, and you'd get a different set of coefficients. And in principle, then, you would get a set of coefficients for anywhere on this circle as it scans across the map. So you could actually get, like, a surface of different values as you went across that map. So that's the basic idea of geographically weighted regression. That's, if you like, the first step towards geographically weighted regression. The only complication with doing that, though, is you'll notice, see this point here that's just outside, that's not included. That one that's just inside is included. Suppose I were to very slightly move the centre point there, and therefore consequently move the window very slightly. What would then happen is that suddenly some of the ones that were in would jump out, and some of the ones that weren't in would jump in. So you get this very jerky sort of surface. And the jerkiness might be justified, and I've done some other work, which I won't so much go into today, unless anyone asks me in the pub, I guess. But and that's about dealing with surfaces where they've got discontinuities in them. But the discontinuities here aren't caused by any natural thing. They're just caused by where my data happens to be. Patterns you see as an artifact of a data collection probably aren't great things to think about. So what I want to do is to try to do something to stop this slight jerkiness of things going in and out. So what we do is, instead of just actually including or excluding as a sort of binary thing the values, we have the idea of a decreasing weight function. So that as you go away from the centre of the window, the weight applied to the points gets less, as indicated by the way I shaded the circle here. So the darker bits in the middle get a higher weighting in my regression model, and the ones in the lighter areas have lower influence. So effectively, when you're trying to fit the model, you put more emphasis on getting good predictions on your straight line, things that are in that part of the circle, rather than the ones on the edge. And that actually causes your surfaces to be smooth, because as points move in, they move in only being very slightly weighted, and then they become more prominent if the window moves, and then they're right in the middle, and you get a higher level of weighting. And so, therefore, it's a weighted regression, and it depends on geographically where things are, and that's why it's called geographically weighted regression. And, okay, again, a little bit more maths. Typical ways you might actually want to do your weighting scheme: if UV is the centre of your window, and the distance is the distance between that point UV and the location where your data points are, then if you plug things into this formula here, that's one kind of geographically weighted
schemes that you can use in geographically weighted regression. What this one does, you'll notice, is once you've got a distance further than this quantity h away from the centre of the window, then things have zero weighting, so they just aren't included in the model at all. There are other ones that are based on things like a Gaussian normal distribution shape curve. And then, actually, everything is included, but with very small weights. Now, that's okay, but actually, from a computational viewpoint, basically, it doesn't make a lot of difference what shape you use, so long as you have something that generally dies away, like these diagrams show. But this one's actually better computationally, because once something's weighted at zero, you can drop it from the calculation. So when you've got really huge data sets, it can do stuff like this a lot quicker, and it doesn't actually change the patterns that you see very much. But you could use other ones as well. And I'll come back to this point, this quantity h here. H is basically the radius of the window that I showed before. And that's basically what it corresponds to. And one thing that will change the results of your geographical weighting much more, not so much the shape of this function, so long as you've got something that's sort of high in the middle and falls away, it doesn't matter too much what mathematical form, that's what we found experimentally anyway. But it's a lot more sensitive to this radius. So we maybe need some ways of choosing the radius, and that's the next big thing in GWR. So basically, what we do is, first of all, that's actually the weighting calibration formula, and effectively, what it is just a way of estimating all of the beta coefficients, things that were in that model, at a given location. And all that's really saying is this weight matrix is in your regression model, which isn't in the standard regression formula. And basically, then that weight matrix is the thing that distinguishes GWR from other things. And the weight matrix has to be recalculated for every window that you use. So that's just mathematically what you're seeing there. Now, as I say, what's quite important is the radius of the window. And I'll go into a minute about how you might actually compute that, but first of all, I'll say another variant that we sometimes have to use, which is the idea of adaptive geographically weighted regression. Sometimes it makes more sense for the radius of the window to change depending on where you are. Now, that's not so relevant in this particular example, but one case in point is if you're doing things, say, based on a survey of households, and some of the households are in rural areas and some are in urban areas. In the urban areas, situations and possibly relationships between things can change quite quickly. Maybe only a few blocks away, and the city takes on a very different character. That tends to happen less in rural areas, so you might need a different bandwidth or window size to deal with that. And so there are adaptive methods as well, and usually the way we do that is to say, rather than saying the window's of a particular size, if you take your point where that's your centre of the window, the regression point, you choose it so that you have a certain number of points inside the circle, and if they were more densely packed, you'd have to go out less far to do that, so it would change there. So sometimes that's useful to work with an adaptive window size rather than a fixed one. But the time being, as I say, what you might want to concentrate more rather than that is the idea of not using the adaptive versus fixed thing, but just how do you choose how big the window should be, regardless of whether you're going for an adaptive or a fixed approach. And just to show why that's important, this isn't geographically weighted regression, but there's a way of sometimes fitting curves where you do a similar sort of idea of having a moving window to fit a straight line through a set of data points. And as the window moves, it picks up on a different straight line relationship in the data and ends up following a sort of central curve within the data. So it's a thing a bit like GWR. And the point is, again, it has this idea of a bandwidth. Bandwidth is basically equivalent to the size of the window. And if the bandwidth is very wide, like it's as wide as the whole data in this case, you do just get a straight line through it. And you can see that's not a very good model of the data. Never mind looking at the size of the errors. The issue is just as much that it clearly doesn't characterise the data. The data starts to decrease, the line doesn't. If you get the window right, then it'll do something like that, and you can see just graphically that you've got a good fit. And when you start to make the window too small, it actually starts to sort of hug the data and to follow the random noise in the data. And that's one of the things about just generally the art of fitting statistical models, is to decide when you're actually genuinely fitting something that's describing the process driving the sample you've got, rather than just fitting some random artifacts of the sample. The two things are quite important, and too much
inference can be drawn if you start to basically worry too much about the characteristics of noise in the data rather than the data itself. And the logical conclusion of this is when you end up just fitting all the points perfectly. And the argument is if you just use things like the errors in your fit, that can be misleading. This model here has zero error, but I wouldn't say it's very useful. And the reason it's not very useful, if a new point was to come along, then the chances of one of these lines actually predicting incorrectly would be virtually zero. And that's the criteria that you use to decide when you're starting to overfit. You deliberately take part of your data set away and you try to calibrate the model on the rest of the data set and see how well it predicts the new data set that you've sort of added to it. And if you do that, that's basically a technique called cross-validation. And again, I won't go deeply into it, but the general idea is this idea of taking part of your data away, calibrating the model on the remainder of the data and seeing how well it predicts the part that you took away. So you're pretending it's being presented with new data. And if it's understood the process and modelled the process well, then you should get quite a good fit. If it's over or underfitted, you won't get a good fit. We can do that with GWR. And when we do it with GWR, what you typically get as you change this bandwidth, you tend to get curves like this. And what we've done here is, again, we've used this holdback idea, or another related idea, which I talked a bit more in detail about this morning, of taking out individual variables one at a time and trying to predict them for the rest of the data. But they're really quite similar ideas. Really, they're reasonably interchangeable. And basically, as the bandwidth, this is still for the Georgia example, as the bandwidth increases, you're seeing when it's too small, you get this overfitting problem, and you get bad performance when you try to predict the holdback sample there. And similarly, when the bandwidth gets a bit too large, then it gets towards this global regression. That doesn't particularly work well, because as we've seen from those diagrams, it's not really a global model that actually holds, so it fails to predict well for that reason. And you'll find that there's an optimal location, and that's how you choose your bandwidth. You basically try to find a bandwidth that minimises that curve there. If you do that, that's what I actually get for my slope coefficient. This is for the Georgia data, so that's still looking at the model between the percentage of people with degrees and the percentage of people that weren't born in the US. And, okay, actually, it's a bit more interesting, because what I didn't talk about before was the east-west patterns. I just looked at north and south. But generally, yeah, sure, it does, the slope does increase, but it's also more here and here than in this part here. So there is perhaps something slightly more going on, but definitely it's picked out the geographical variation in that slope. And so it's a way of exploring basically how the model and how the two variables interrelate and how that differs as you look through space. And as well as the slope coefficient, of course those line models have an intercept coefficient, and we can show you how they look as well. And whoops, that's a bit too enthusiastic. Whoops, that's just good. But yeah, that's the intercept coefficient. And again, interestingly, the intercept one actually is higher when you lower down and lower up when you go further north. But in fact, probably the dominant effect in that is the one of the slope, which is usually the case. The other thing you can do is...
Hang on, Chris. So what are you using the intercept coefficient for? What's that?
Oh, it's just when you're fitting the line. It's basically... So actually, what I can do is if I go back a couple... Hang on. Bear with me. That one takes a bit longer to replace than the others. But if I go right back... Right. Now, when you've got these different straight lines you're fitting, the slope is just showing the slope of the line. The intercept is just where these points hit zero. And what it's actually saying is, although the lines are slightly less sloped, the starting point is actually a little bit higher when you're lower down, but then gets gradually a little bit lower as you move further up. So basically, it's just the way that the line actually fits this data. Generally, the increase is the same, but it's actually saying that... In fact, it does kind of make sense, because what it's saying is actually for lower levels of people who are foreign born, you actually get a lower level of degrees when there's more of a concentration, sorry, more of a relationship between them. So, therefore, that is actually gradually dropping as you get higher. And so if I go forward, but again, you know, there's a bit of, that it's not just a story of things changing
north and south, but what it's really just doing is telling you what level you would expect. If there were zero people with who were not born in the US, then how many percentage would you expect them to have degrees? But in fact, I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. One of the
So the slope coefficient isn't helping us to identify particular regions?
Well, it is, because it's changing as you go from region to region.
So why then isn't there more of a particular coefficient centred around the university in the image you showed?
Oh, because what it's actually picking up is not just one place, it would be the whole set of areas around it. So what it's basically saying is probably in the university area there'll be some places where employees of the university tend to live and others where they don't. And in the ones where they do tend to live, there'll probably be higher proportions both of people with degrees and people who weren't born in the US. And then the other places where they don't tend to live, there'll be lower proportions of both things because, you know, it's probably in those places, generally, quite likely anyway, that, you know, that there's a link between the two variables. So it's basically, what it's telling you really is that it's characterised by the contrast between the two things being explained in that area, in and around the university, not just at the place where the university is. Yep. Again, it's a take-home message, it's about relationships between variables changing spatially. So you sometimes need to go out a bit further to see the contrasts. And that's really what was kind of going on there. And the other thing is, when I did my geographically weighted regressions in these cases, you'll notice I just shaded in actually the counties. So what I did for my regression points, I just chose the centre points of the counties, which was the same places where I had the data. But there's nothing to stop you, for example, putting in a set of regular grid points to work out your regression points, which is just to finally leave this data set. I've just done another example showing you the slope coefficient, but in this case, just showing it varying continuously. To be honest, since really what you're doing is exploring relationships to some extent, it probably doesn't make a lot of difference which of the two things. Yeah.
If you go back to the previous slide, I mean, it's very interesting because it seems to say that where in those areas where there's not so many foreign-born people, you've actually got a higher in the southern areas. There's fewer foreign-born people, there are more university graduates, as it were, for zero foreign-born.
Yes.
That's what the intercept.
Yes, it's basically saying people. Yeah, sorry.
So when you've got zero foreign-born, as it were, where it hits the UI axis, that the percentage of graduates at that zero level is higher in the south than in the north. And that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, well, what it's saying is that's true, but what it's sort of saying, I guess, is that for the places where you've got, you know, the higher level, as you say, in the south areas, it's saying that they're not necessarily the places where the graduates are living. So, you know, there's a separation of them because, you know, there might be people who are foreign-born for an entirely different reason. And then the graduate levels are actually kind of, you know, they're just very more or less independently of that. And that's kind of why, it's not such a good predictor. So low levels of one thing don't necessarily imply low levels of the other thing. Okay. It's because of people, if you like, perhaps clustering together, that you're getting both things going up together, sort of thing, in the higher regions. So when they do go up, you know, there'll be high levels of graduates where there are also high levels of foreign-born. Whereas it'll just be a random thing in the south, because there's not much correlation. It's not actually going from a negative to a positive correlation here. It's really going from a low positive to a high positive correlation.
It's basically saying that foreign-born is a poor predictor.
Yes, in those places, that's right, yes. Whereas it's a better predictor in the north. Yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. Yeah.
But is it foreign-born that are attending university, or is it foreign-born in the state of Georgia?
It's just foreign-born as a base of the population in those counties. So per county, so the baseline is the people in the in each county. So it's the proportion of foreign born in each county. Okay, so yeah, this is then, as I say, just moving onto that. That's just a slope coefficient, but again, it's really showing you much the same thing. I suppose really I'm showing that to say sometimes people like to show it as a continuous thing, sometimes just by states, but really, to be honest, you know, they pretty much show the same pattern. So, just to really finish off on this particular example, and really just to say a bit more about GWR, you can work out a few other things. One of the things you can work out is a local standard error, so you can see how reliable your coefficients are. And one of the things you might see, for example, is in the southern areas, the coefficients aren't actually significantly different from zero, whereas in the north they are. So, you know, there's some sort of connection before. Some sort of connection as you go further north. And the way you can do that, largely speaking, that's done using Monte Carlo approaches. It's quite difficult, because you're doing this sort of moving window thing, to understand the mathematical statistical distributions of the varying coefficients. But using techniques like Bootstrap and Monte Carlo-based techniques, you can do tests on this. And one of the ideas, just simply, is to say, well, if we assume there was no spatial pattern, I could randomly scramble the coordinates of the counties against the census data. And then I look at the estimates I'm getting when I do that, and I look at how variable they are, and I compare that to the ones I've actually got. And if the variability of the ones I'm getting and other methods of measuring spatial patterns of the ones I'm actually getting are much, much higher in my real data than in the scrambled data, that tells me that probably this wasn't something that arose from just a random variation of the characteristics with space. So that's something you can test, because if it was just random, you could have just fitted a global regression model and discarded the spatial information. And so there are tests for things like that. And just very quickly, I want to talk about the fact that you can get multivariate geographically weighted regression as well. That means that instead of just putting one particular variable in, you can put more than one in. So for example here, I've got the same foreign-born as I had before, and that's the regression surface for that. But this time, when I've got an extra variable in the regression model, which is the percentage of people over 65. Because if we're saying this is something about the working population, then looking at the elderly population might also spread some extra light in that. And what it has done, I have to say, although that north-south trend is still there, it's not looking quite the same as it did before. And possibly, you know, there's other factors going on in there as well. And what this is bringing me on to is the fact that, generally speaking, this is true with all regression techniques, not just geographically weighted regression, it can be quite difficult to interpret the results of multivariate regression. And one of the reasons it's difficult is that quite often, if there's a linkage between the two predictor variables, that's the sort of thing that can give you very inconsistent and patterns that change. It might be that, yeah.
Can I just check, this is a mark of the correlation coefficient?
The regression coefficients.
Regression
coefficients, sorry, yes, that's correct. Yes, so basically these regression coefficients, when you're trying to predict the number of people with degrees, so you've got the foreign-born and the elderly as the predictor variables in this particular model. What it's done is it's picked out generally this north-south pattern, whereas before there was a sort of area with slightly less strong relationship, it's actually only on one side now, not on the other. And that's something that, although it doesn't happen in terms of the maps you get, if you did global regressions, you tend to get that effect happening sometimes. One of the things is that, of the things I've been thinking about lately, when you're trying to handle multivariate relationships, rather than thinking of this idea of one thing that you're trying to predict and the other thing's trying to predict it, you need to think about the interrelationship between all of the variables. And that's why I want to kind of move on to something different in the second part of the talk, and talk about, instead of thinking about geographically weighted regression for certain kinds of variables, actually to think about an alternative geographical weighting approach. This has worked well for a lot of things, but sometimes you can get confusing things happen, and then there's got to be possibly ways around that. But one way it's worked extremely well is things like predicting house prices, when you can put in lots of variables about the characteristics of the house, like the number of bedrooms, the size of the garden, and so forth. And we got very good and fairly uncontradictory results out of that. But what happens when you do start to get these correlated things, and how do you go about interpreting it? And so that brings me on to the next idea, which is geographically weighted principal components analysis. And what I'm going to try and do with this is try and justify, well, again, we're not going to talk about geographically weighted things first off, we'll just talk about generally the difference between multivariate relationships in regression and PCA. Generally speaking, the kind of problems you get with regression are to do with collinearity or correlation in the predictor variables. If the predictor variables are correlated, so that when one thing goes up, another thing also goes up, it's hard to work out which things are influencing the Y variable. And I can give you an example of this, not in terms of geographical things, but in terms of drug trials. Suppose you have two drugs just called A and B, and they're supposed to reduce blood pressure. And you've got one group of people you give neither drug to, and the other group of people you give drugs both A and B to, and the results appear to reduce blood pressure. What you don't know is whether the reduction was caused entirely from drug A, entirely from drug B or from some sort of combination, because you've only got information about neither drug or having both drugs. And if you like, in that case, your predictor variables are the presence or absence of the two drugs. And your sample correlated because they're either both not there or both there. And you get a kind of continuous version of that when you put several variables that are correlated into a regression model. If you put in something like house price drops because of crime rate, but also drops because of some other factor, noise from an airport, if you've only got places with high crime rates that are near to airports in your study, you won't know, and then other places that have low crime rates that aren't near to airports, you won't know which of the two things has actually caused the drop in the house price. And so positive correlation can be a problem. Negative correlation can cause its own kind of problems as well. So for example, if you find that, again the drug A and B thing, if you only give, if you give some people drug A and some people drug B, and it appears that drug A works better than drug B, is that, it could be that drug B actually has no effect and drug A has some, or it could be that they both have some effects and they're both better than giving people neither drug, and you don't know that in that situation. So it's still a lack of information you get when you have correlated input variables, and it's better if you can possibly get things as independent as possible. And that's one of the problems with regression. It's in the nature of regression. If you do design clinical trials, you can control those things, so you don't have these correlated samples. But if you don't do that, if you do something that's from social data where you can't control what the predictive variables are going to be, then you sometimes have a problem on your hands. And so one of the ways forward is actually to think about principal components analysis instead of regression. And although that's sometimes thought of as an exploratory technique, it is also a modelling technique, and I'll show you why in a moment. And basically, it can identify collinearity, but still provide information in the other data once the collinearity has been taken account of. And that's why sometimes PCA is a useful thing to do. And particularly what I'm interested in here, another thing about looking at multivariate data is sometimes you want to find multivariate outliers as well as multivariate patterns. And this can be quite a good way of doing that. So just generally, PCA sometimes is a useful way of thinking about data, when, particularly when your linear regression models aren't working well because of problems of collinearity and correlation of data. And if we take a TMD case, I'll try and explain what the difference is between principal components and regression. So let's just say I've got two variables, x and y. The points here are my x, y variables. They represent them on a scatter plot. The line is the best fit line for an ordinary least squares regression. And the errors we're minimising are these blue lines on here. So basically, we're only really concerned about predicting the y. Well, we don't penalise when x is a long way away from the line, only y. That's the way regression works. That's because if you actually write down the equations, you minimise the difference between the predicted and the actual y values. You say nothing about x. Suppose, on the other hand, you do something like this. What we've now done is we actually want to minimise the straight line distance in x and y between the points and the line. And we want to find a line that minimises those distances instead of the previous set of distances. And if you do that, well, basically, you do get a different set of answers out. What you get here, because you've got these lines here that have to be minimised, these blue lines, the lengths of these have to be minimised, you actually get a different slope of line and a different intercept of the line than you had previously. So if we go back to there, just note roughly where the line is, and note, say, the two points at the three points at the top in a line in relation to those. And now if we bring that forward, you can see it is different in terms of the way it goes there. It actually goes pretty much directly through that line. It didn't do before. So it's a different line, because you've actually asked it to optimise a different thing. And really what's interesting about this is your problem is now symmetric. You haven't treated y differently from x. And that actually makes sense in a lot of social data. Why are you interested in thinking that crime rate is the only random thing, and not unemployment, and not house prices? They're all random processes in there. And a standard regression model really actually, because it's only trying to measure the y, it's assuming all your x's are known and deterministic, and the y is the only random thing. Which made sense in the idea of regression originally, which was for things like drug trials, but doesn't make sense always for social data. So that's actually a better way of doing things. And the point is, that actually turns out a means of explaining how PCA works. Rather than talking about components of the loadings and variance in that sort of way, basically, PCA actually is that line-fitting algorithm, and that's equivalent to principal components solving that problem. And it's based on perpendicular rather than horizontal distances. So it treats x and y equally. And residuals, you still have a concept of residuals in PCA, which is effectively the distances along these blue lines. And in fact, if you're just doing a 2D principal components analysis, which you would be with just two variables, then the projection points along this line are the scores for the first component, and the lengths of these lines are actually the scores for the second component. So actually, principal components analysis is a kind of symmetric regression. And for that reason, the other thing that's worth looking at is the equation of the best fit line. That would be a linear expression in terms of the two variables. That actually gives you the loadings of the components. So when you normally do principal components analysis and you have a set of loadings on the variables, that's what these are. And the projections correspond to the scores. What that means is, well, a number of things really. First of all, usually you don't just do principal components analysis on 2D data. You do it in multivariate data. But effectively, what you can say is if you take the first k, regardless of what k is, components of an n-dimensional data set, that actually finds the k-dimensional linear subspace that minimises those distances. So in three dimensions, it would be a plane that fits through the points, but minimises the distances perpendicular. So again, it treats all three dimensions equally. And I can't imagine or describe what's happened in 20 dimensions, but it's doing the same thing then as well. That's the nature of it. And always, if you choose the first k components, then the remaining n minus k components are effectively the residuals. So you can basically say how well the best linear subspace of the model is one thing, and the variances from that are the remaining components, the higher components after the first ones. And that's one way of interpreting PCA. And one of the nice things is if you do get collinearities then, it's not so much of a problem. All it means is that you just get zero residuals from that line if everything did lie on the line. That would be like having very, very high correlation in your data set. And basically then in the higher dimensions, an ordination plot is essentially to do with the coordinates being projected onto your subspace. The 2D ordination plot means that you make k equals 2 and project them onto that subspace, for those of you who are familiar with such things. And then the distances, which is to do with the rest of the components, the high levels of the level of the rest of the components, are basically your, what I'm calling, there's two types of outliers here. Basically, the distances are kind of measures of how you've got individual points that don't fit well into that subspace. So if we went back to my line model, even when you've got a perpendicular distance, some of the points didn't fit well onto that line. And there's basically two kinds of outliers, I would argue, in that case. If things are well approximated by a lower dimensional subspace, which is pretty much what happens in a lot of social data, where you might get 30 variables only measuring about 8 things, then there's two kinds of outliers. And I'll just go back to the original plot to show that idea. And the two kinds of outliers are basically things on this line that are unusually high or low. And the second kind are things where these residuals are very high. Let's say, for example, that was a measure, let's say it was something like number of households without cars, or percentage of households without cars on one axis, and percentage of households where children had free school dinners on another. Now, they both possibly be arguably measures of deprivation, and you might expect them to be a bit like this, you know, high levels of one tend to go with high levels of the other. Now, when you do your analysis here, basically what's happening is you've got two sorts of outliers. The projection onto this line generally then measures deprivation. You've either got people down here who've got low on both things, so they're actually relatively not very deprived, and people at the other end are high on both things, so they're relatively highly deprived. Now you can get one kind of outlier, which is where the projection on that line has very high points, and that just means that they're deprived, if you like, in a standard way, they're very poor on both things, but the level is actually very unusually high for those people. But you've got another sort of outlier, which is what happens when you've got a strong residual from that line. And it might be that not necessarily they've got a particularly unusual value for either of the two variables. They might be sort of mid-range for both things. But they're an unusual combination. So if you like, the first slot is saying, well, there is a general sort of way of approximating a general pattern in there, like both of these things measure deprivation. You've got very highly or very lowly deprived people or families or areas or whatever. But
There's a second sort of outlier, which is where someone doesn't fit into that model. So they've got like a very high level of school dinners and a very low level of no car ownership, which might, for example, happen in a very rural area that had poor access to public transport. So even if people had quite low incomes, they prioritise cars much more highly than in another place. So they're my type 1 and type 2 outliers. And I'll just sort of wind things up a bit by saying, well, the second thing about this is you could then geographically weight your principal components analysis, and you could say, well, in that case, you could say you could actually get kinds of outliers of this both sorts in one region and not in another. So basically you might say, well, you could get an area where someone was not perhaps unusually highly deprived in Britain as a whole, but because they lived in quite an affluent area, it would be unusual to have that level of deprivation. And also you could have another area where there perhaps wasn't much correlation, so there was generally quite a high level of the second kind of outlier. But again, you know, it might be just that it's unusual for the relationship in that particular area rather than in another area. So the basic idea here is we're doing principal components analysis, but it's weighted, and it's weighted in the same way that GWR is weighted. And a very quick example of this, just to show that you don't only need to do this sort of stuff on human geography data, is something called the Baltic Soil Survey, where agricultural soils were collected from 10 European countries over a large region surrounding the Baltic Sea. 768 points here, and there are a number of compounds that were measured for the content, these different chemical compounds, and for each of them their percentage by weight in the soil sample was computed. And because there are 10 different compounds that we're considering here at least, the data's got 768 rows and 10 columns, and also we recorded their location. And the data was then just standardised to Z-scores, so that everything was on the same scale in case percentage components changed from different points. And our key task here was try to identify different kinds of outliers and local patterns using geographically weighted principal components analysis. So that's our data set. These were all the samples were. You can see in some places they're more regular in the way they were collected than others, but that's just the nature of the sample. But those were where my 768 points were. There's a way of doing cross-validation with these as well, again, because you're looking at these residuals and you can take hold back sample and find the best bandwidth for that. That's the bandwidth, I think, in kilometres this time. It's about 1450 kilometres. We again went for a regular fixed bandwidth because the density of the points was fairly permanent in there. And, well, we did various things about it. One of the things we just looked at was the highest loading of the components in the soils. And so in other words, this was the thing that varied most. It doesn't mean that in this place everywhere was dominated by Fe or iron compounds. What it means is it's the iron thing that most contrasted things in those areas. Aluminium in these areas, potassium here, and yes, titanium in these areas here. So basically that there are different kinds of characteristics in terms of the variability in the soil in each of these places. We found that using the PCA. We've also looked at actually trying to represent each of the individual loadings. There were 10 of them, don't forget, in this data set. And this was the first principal component. And although it's a bit hard to tell what's going on, what you can see, when they're red, that means they're a negative loading, and when they're black, they're a positive loading. Whereas a lot of them were entirely positively loaded, when you get down here, one of them was negatively loaded, and that meant that that was actually contrasting that particular component against the other ones. So it's presence or absence of that thing. And if you go back to find out what that thing was, if you look at that map there, it was aluminium. It was actually the one that it was doing. And in case you're wondering why they're called sternutation plots, does anyone know what the medical term sternutation actually means? That means sneezing. Because basically someone looked at these things and said it looks like someone sneezed on it. So that's basically why they're called sternutation plots. You can do the same thing with the second component, and actually you get quite strong patterns in there. Then again, the loadings were very much based on contrast between just one of the elements. I need the one showing you the symbols for that, which I don't actually have on me at the moment. But you can see there that, again, it picks out the spatial variation in these different components as you move around. One of the other things we just looked at was the different sign patterns for the loadings. So regardless of the values, whether the loadings were either positive or negative,
Because there were 10 things and each thing could be either, potentially there were 1,024 possibilities. Only 3 actually turned up in the sample, so there was only 3 different possible loadings. One of them was basically contrasting silicon with the other things. One was contrasting the potassium, and the other one was actually saying that basically all of the things were equally loaded, which was basically contrasting those. There were actually some other components that weren't that weren't considered in this, so basically contrasting those against the rest. And if you've got those 3 classes, again, you can draw maps of those and see what the spatial patterns are in this. Basically, because it's highly multivariate and we're looking at the way the 10 variables interact, and B, I'm not a soil scientist, someone's got to go away and think about these, probably not me, unfortunately, but there we go. But the other thing we're able to do is to, remember I talked about outliers and finding the residuals. We did a thing where we standardised the residuals and then picked out any of them that had a value greater than 3, so we divided them by their standard, well, subtracted the mean divided by the standard deviation. When we got ones that were bigger than 3, we found these 4 outliers that were unusual in terms of the composition of the area that they were in. Again, using these sort of perpendicular outliers. And just finally then, we basically plotted these against parallel coordinates plots. The idea of parallel coordinate plots is if you've got your measurement for each of these values, you draw a line along these axes here showing you the relative values of these, so you get a sort of profile. And the background there is doing that with the whole of the rest of the data set, but actually changing their intensity. And furthermore, it's actually geographically weighting these intensities, so they're also taking into account the nearness. So any particular line that's drawn here, not for the site 250 that we're interested in, was actually drawn in a lighter colour, lighter grey, depending on how far away it was from site 250. And that, these ones here were done for site 20 and so forth. And what you can see there is the relative distances between those, relative differences between those and the underlying patterns. And basically what you can see, for example, this site 165 seems to be quite low on everything, so probably its other characteristics are in there, but that was an unusually low profile. This site has a very, very high potassium level. That one was calcium that was high, and also potassium, phosphorus. And the, that's phosphorus, that one. And again, this one was also very high in terms of phosphorus. So we can use it to identify multivariate outliers, and that's generally quite difficult to do, because you need a 10-dimensional plot to do it otherwise, so you need something like this to help you. And if you're also saying they're outliers because they're different from local soils rather than they're different from the global sample, then you get even more variables. So just to very quickly wind up, then one of the things I've been thinking about is it's actually quite useful to look at this sort of PCA approach for both human and physical geography data. But I'm perhaps using it more as a data mining tool now than as a modelling tool. Although for geographical PCA being useful as a data mining tool, I think thinking about it, PCA is actually a kind of model. It's just that it's a model that tries to penalise not just errors in the prediction of Y, but in prediction of the whole data set, all of the variables. So possibly data mining and data modelling isn't such a clear-cut distinction, and maybe there's a bit of everything in both of those. And the other thing we're thinking about at the moment is trying to think about how we can best use these things in a large number of data sets, but also thinking about further extensions of the technique. The other thing that's shown is that you can take, remember I said right at the beginning that geographical weighting is based on the idea of getting a template and allowing the certain characteristics to change locally. And GWPCA is also the same as the loadings or the perpendicular modelling, if you use that interpretation of it, that changes locally. And are there any other techniques that we could do some similar thing for? And would it be worth it? Would we be able to do anything useful with it? And those are some of the things we've got to consider. Okay, so that's me done there.
Weighty. Had to be done. Well, it's a very full talk, very interesting. Particularly like the equations. I hope you did too. Questions. I think we can squeeze in a few questions. We'll definitely save some of them for the pub, perhaps. But if we can get a few burning issues before we go. Jamie.
Thanks, Chris. That was great. Really enjoyed that. Really interesting. And I think you cut through some really tricky and technical issues in such a clear and concise way. So thanks very much for that. I wanted, there's probably some people in the room who are thinking you're interested in using GWR. And I just wondered whether you just might be able to clarify a little bit on the utility of GWR over some other approaches. And perhaps coming back to your examples at the start, you talked about the second Barthes effect. And an alternative way of looking at that might be to use a standard regression approach and then test interactions between second bathroom and whatever the variable was. Similarly, with your example on the board, you could use a multi-level model and you could be able to tease out effects at different levels. So level two could be city, and therefore you would test those effects between London and Newcastle. So I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about how GWR might be an alternative.
Okay. To those issues. Well, I mean, one of the things, there are almost two separate examples there, but if I go to the bathroom example, what I was basically doing there is, you're right, if you knew some of the other variables, you could do that. Part of the value of it is that it might be being used as an exploratory technique. You might not know those to start with. So if you ran the model like that, and you looked at the geographical patterns, it might be, yes, you're right, that it's a forerunner to choosing another variable to put into the model. But if you didn't know that in the first place, it might be useful as an exploratory thing to identify what variable that might be. So that's one reason why you might want to do it. It might make sense of that. The other thing is that it might not just be one variable that's causing that thing to happen. It might be the interaction of several variables, some of which might be to do with sort of cultural attitudes of people that can't necessarily be measured. And things like that you could pick up by just saying, well, okay, we don't know, well, we can't quantify what's going on in this place, even though maybe we know things are different there. You could pick up patterns like that, even though you're just doing it empirically, and just see that there's a difference there. And then maybe think more qualitatively about that. So it may be, by getting geographical patterns out explicitly, it might help us to think about processes and also things that change spatially but can't easily be measured. So that's probably the advantage for the first one. The second one you said about using sort of multi-level models and things like that. Well, admittedly, in my example there, you probably could have done, because I chose two spatially distinct places anyway. I just said London and Newcastle, I think I said. And of course, if you just had two separate data sets like that, you could just split the thing into two and do it that way. The problem is what happens is sometimes more subtle than that. And in fact, there might be spatial changes, but you don't know necessarily where the transition zone actually is. And you could use a multi-level model, but you have to actually specify where the levels of change actually are in advance. The advantage here is you could see where they are. It might even be that once you've identified them, you might again want to use a multi-level model afterwards, but it wouldn't pick you up in the first place where the changes were. The problem with a multi-level model is you have to impose the geography on the analysis initially. And what this allows you to do is to explore what the geography is.
A couple of weeks ago, the government released all the crime data for the UK.
They did.
Good or bad?
Interesting point. The fact they released it, I think if it's analysed properly, good. And now it will be a bit controversial because I'm not entirely sure that's happened with the current website. There's all kinds of interesting things that have happened with it. But the biggest problem, which isn't a GWR thing, but it's quite an interesting thing, is what they've done is they've basically aggregated it to area levels. That was good because, that's protecting the privacy of the individual. So that aspect of it definitely good. The way it's then been represented as point data on the website, just in the centre of the location, and not, say, as just a shading of the whole neighbourhood area, bad, because basically what it's now doing is making it look as though there's a crime wave outside somebody's house, because the only crime that's been committed is the house unfortunately happens to be near the centroid of an arbitrary area. So the visualisation thing, bad.
My broader issue, the reason why I think it links to what you're talking about, is that the interpretation of data seems to me to require a great deal of careful critique, as these simple examples show. And there's a total absence of that, and I can't. And so I think it's actually, I think it's wrong. I mean, a lot of people say it's inherent. There's an inherent belief that the release of this data informs the public, but I don't think it informs the public. So it doesn't empower them.
I would agree with that because you're right, it's tricky to actually see what the patterns are. And I think, again, one of the
issues with this whole release of that data, and the way it's been presented on the website seems to have almost bypassed anyone who actually knows about geographical data analysis or, you know, spatial analysis, or for that matter, visualization. And because of that, I kind of feel that there are problems there.
Sorry, can I just come in from Scottish Government there? Because, you know, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. If we don't release the data, we're told you're keeping it secret. Yeah. If we do release the data, then we're told, well, actually, we're not analysing it properly. It can be analysed in all this way. And you know, I'm not any kind of statistician, as anybody knows me, will tell you. You lost me on the 20th dimension. But you know, there's obviously all sorts of ways of crunching data. I think that our responsibility, surely, as a public authority, is to release the data in the best way that we can, with the granularity that we can, to you know, maintain confidentiality, etc. Then worry about it, because that's why we employ armies of statisticians to analyse the data, to put the government spin on it. Now, it's up to you as an academic or whoever to take that data and then crunch it in any way they want to come up to justify any point that they want to make. But the fact is, we're all working on the same data, and we can come up with different interpretations about it based on how we interpret it. So surely, what we need to do is get the data out there in the first place. And then worry about the interpretation.
I don't personally have a problem with the data being released. The thing that concerned me more was the way it's actually been presented. So, in fact, no, I applaud the fact personally that it's been released. But I would also agree with William that you know, it's very important that you do you know, interpret it properly. But yeah, that's my problem as much as anything else. That's my job, and I've got to make sure that that is understood. So I think the thing I was taking issue with more wasn't the release of the data, it was sort of what happens with afterwards when it went onto the website. I'd be more than happy to take the data that's aggregated, that's fair enough, and think about better ways of representing that graphically, because it's actually, the problem at the moment is just this issue with the way it's been represented. It's not, to me anyway, a problem that the data's been released or that it was aggregated in the way it was. It's then about the way it was presented subsequently that I think's problematic.
As somebody who used factor analysis and principal components analysis, but some time ago, perhaps I should say that there was a decade or two when I was mixing with my fellow human geographers, I would keep that quite secret. It was kind of, what's the word, almost treated very pejoratively among human geographers. But no, I'm used to doing factor analysis where you have you start with essentially correlation coefficients, okay? And you then look at the relationships between the correlation coefficients as angles, and you fit your axes to those. And I mean, geographically weighted principal components analysis, I mean, it sounds very interesting, great, sounds like it's got a great potential, but I'm still trying to get my mind around some of the earlier steps.
Oh, well, the thing about the perpendicular distances, or?
Not so much that, it's... Mm-hmm. Are you starting your factor analysis, in your kind of factor analysis, are you starting it with you know, as it were, placing the variables as vectors in relation to each other in terms of the correlation coefficients being translated into loadings, or are you factor analysing the original kind of raw data in its sort of multi-dimensional attribute space?
Well, if you take the interpretation, I mean, essentially what you've just described is factor analysis, or, you know, it's very similar to principal components analysis. And what it turns out is that the mathematics of doing it the way I did and the way that you did, if you do it universally, not locally, give you the same numbers. What we actually do, if you think about it in terms of the correlation matrix analysis terms, effectively, it's equivalent to doing a geographically weighted correlation matrix. So the weights in your windows at any location is used to derive a correlation matrix for that location. And then the loadings are calculated for that point. And then you do that for every point on the map. So, you know, if you go back to the really simple idea of the moving window, and the points that go in and out of it. You're basically doing a principal components analysis on those points.
I'm okay with that. I'm just not quite sure about whether you're still not quite sure whether you're starting the process in sort of initial data matrix attribute space, or you're working in the next stage from that, which is the matrix of correlation coefficients.
We're starting with the raw data, and then using the moving window, because each of the matrix of raw data has got a spatial reference. You then take all of that part of the matrix that is within your window, and then you calculate the correlation matrix just for those points. Then you do you work out the loadings from that matrix for that location there. And then as you move around, the actual loadings will change as that window moves. And then the only extra thing, again, is we do the weighting thing. So the correlation matrix is based on weighted data in the same way as the regression one was. So basically, we started with the raw data, but selecting parts of it out using a geographical window, and then putting that raw data through the whole process and coming out with the principal components analysis. I'm not quite sure how that fits into the way you've said it, but basically, we're actually choosing, we're taking chunks of the data out on a geographical basis, on a moving window basis, and doing the analysis on those. That's effectively what I was doing, because when you take the perpendicular distance, that actually takes the closest distance, taking into account horizontal and vertical.
Okay.
So it's got a yeah. So you're right. That's exactly what you want to do, but that's what it was doing.
Well, just going to throw in if you did it back to the X instead, but that's probably a silly question. And Bruce, do you have one?
I was just very interested in your conclusions, Chris, in terms of using this as part of data mining. Of course, that is a very sensible thing to do, and reflecting on the fact that clearly the whole area of data mining in terms of GIS is one that is not really very well exploited, yet there is a huge amount of potential there. What issues do you think there are in terms of operationalizing this technique into the software? You know, when will it become part of Oracle Spatial? Is that a dangerous thing to do because it's a technique you really need to understand what you're doing with it before you take that step? What are your views on that?
Well, I do think that, you know, like a lot of techniques, you do need to be able to understand them and just, you know, realise how you should interpret them. That's just generally the case. But technically, I think one of the big steps is if you're going to do this with really huge databases, it's quite computationally intensive. And things like parallel processing, I think, are going to come into play. And using grid-based computers, what you might find is, though, that the technique does quite nicely lend itself to that, because you're doing things in terms of localities and taking chunks of the data depending on where they are. It isn't unreasonable to split the data up geographically and send that off to lots of machines, do the analysis. In fact, we've done a little bit of work on that with geographically weighted regression, not with the PCA and the data mining, to do that. But I think that's one of the challenges, is to make it workable. A, you're right that one of the things is to make sure that people know what they're doing. But again, that's sort of my problem. I've got to explain it properly, and if I don't, that's my fault as well. But the other side of it is that, yes, being able to make it work, but the other thing that people will do is they'll say, they won't say I've got 700 a sample, they'll say I've got 7 million in my sample, and what do I do then? And that's a key technical issue, because I think these days that's quite likely to happen. You know, lots of volunteer geographical information and things like that will have huge amounts of data in there.
It's true that the technique is naturally parallelizing, in that if you are carrying out several independent windows on our data set, that number is actually very large. So naturally distributes across the machine very easily. It's actually coordinating the results afterwards. That's stopping you.
No, we looked into that with GWR, and that's actually right. And the other thing that we found, that what we did need was a lot of distance matrices, you know, for distances between the regression points and where the data was. And actually shifting those about was one of our bigger headaches in terms of the parallel algorithm, more than, I mean, that part, as you said, what's the term they use, embarrassingly parallel?
Yeah.
And, you know, it is an embarrassingly parallel problem for that part of it, but it was some of the other bits of it that were harder to deal with. That's quite true.
Right. been, I guess, probably brass monkey. I think it would be close to potential eateries. So if we can thank again Chris for a very full, interesting talk. You might be able to help me by finishing off what's left in the back there. We'll clear up and we'll meet Brass Monkey just along Grumman Street and possibly further other chats. Okay, thanks again.
Cheers.